everybody. Welcome back to the SWAT Show. I am Simon Ward, founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and this is the number one resource for performance-minded triathletes like you. It's called the SWATcast. We try to keep it to a weekly 30-minute show, but we don't always if we've got great guests on. And we feature practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches, and experts from the world of triathlon so you can get the most from your training time and maximize your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. And if you want to get more of this with some really engaged, insightful people, why don't you hop across and join my free Facebook community called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. And my guest today has already said he's going to be on there. He's back for the second podcast. It's Mr. Brad Cairns. Welcome, Brad.
Oh, glad to be back, Simon. Thank you. I had a great time on the first show, and we set up some good topics to discuss here, so I look forward to getting into it.
Well, we do, but for those of you who can't remember back to our last call or are just joining us for the first time and maybe want to go back and catch up on that, Brad Cairns is a former champion triathlete way back in the 90s. Some of you may not even realize that triathlon existed back then, so Brad was one of the founding fathers of performance triathlon. He's also the co-author of the book The Primal Endurance, which if you haven't read it already, I would thoroughly recommend. I actually bought it as a gift for several people last year, so that's how much I liked it. And Brad is also the host of the online Primal Endurance Mastery course, which you can find at primalendurance.fit. So, Brad, I've already set the scene. We've got 30 minutes. We did all the prep work last week for Primal Endurance, so let's get into it now. Let's say in front of us we've got some age group triathletes, because that's really our demographic that we're aiming for, and they've heard about this, they've maybe read the book, and they're still not convinced, and it's our job to try and help them fit this primal endurance philosophy principle into their current lifestyle to turn them into better triathletes and higher performing human beings. Where are we going to start?
Well, that's the perfect setup right there, because we have this, you know, highly intelligent, highly educated, highly motivated, driven, focused audience. No one else would be crazy enough to attempt a triathlon, right? Mm. And you have this problem of, you know, not being convinced, because if we take this kind of, you know, basic approach where you have a really daunting event that you've just signed up for and you want to get competent at it and prepare for it, the mind and the insecurities and all the emotions that come into the forefront, you know, we're compelled to kind of push our bodies really hard day after day after day in training as we obsess about yet another peak performance goal that we've set for ourselves. And we've been so successful in our life, making it through school and making it up the corporate ranks and whatever else we've achieved with, you know, that dogged determination and refusal to give up and refusal to give in to fatigue or lack of focus or things that, you know, less accomplished and less driven people suffer from. So I'm here to say and propose that maybe some of these strengths that you have that have gotten you so far in life and help you achieve so much great success can also become, you know, severe weaknesses when you're trying to become competent as an endurance athlete, because the pattern of chronic training, of overtraining and overly stressful lifestyle patterns in general is prevalent. It's epidemic among the endurance athlete scene. So the convincing is going to take place where if you slow down and reduce the overall stress level of your exercise program, you will thrive. You will get better and you will go faster by virtue of preserving your health as you pursue fitness.
Can I stop you there for a moment, Brad? Imagine that I'm a member of the audience now and I'm hearing you say this and I'm telling you, I've been reading for years that I have to train hard, that I have to push myself, that I need to go to bed fatigued, I need to struggle to get up in the morning. In fact, if I do not follow a philosophy of suffering in training and struggling to get the work done, I won't succeed in my goal of getting to Hawaii or representing Great Britain in age group world championships. And that's what I read. Every time I pick up a triathlon magazine, I read that. You need to suffer. You need to struggle. You need to learn to deal with pain. And you're telling me that's wrong?
Well, if we want to be black and white about it, yeah, that's a very high-risk approach.
Wow.
That said, you know, we have these daunting athletic challenges and we have to approximate the challenge of the race in training if we want to excel in the race. So once in a while, it's very favorable. It will produce excellent results if you approximate the challenge of your race and training. I've coached Ironman people for so long, and they have this mindset that they have to go and put in these big miles in all three events and make sure they do 15 workouts a week or more, whatever the stuff is. And I'll ask, like, how many times this year leading up to your race have you swum 4,000 meters and then immediately toweled off and jumped on your bike and did a 112-mile time trial? Yeah. And most people never do that except for race day. And then they notice that at mile 35, they start to get back spasms because they've never been in the water without stopping, without an interval workout where you're doing different sets and you're resting for 3 minutes and putting on kickboards and then taking a 30-minute breakfast break before you get on your bike and ride 112. I'm a big fan of what we call key workouts, breakthrough workouts, where you're doing something that's directly applicable to that challenge that you're facing in a future race.
Specific.
But I'm also a big fan of specific.
Specificity, yeah.
Rest periods. Yeah, and taking way more rest than you might be comfortable with because of the flawed cultural ideals that still prevail in endurance sports. And in the previous show, we talked about, it's been years since I competed on the circuit, but the same stuff was coming up back then as it is today. The leading athletes still get injured. They get sick. They bomb out of big races. They make all these mistakes in training because everyone's obsessed with how much work can I perform because that will lead me to the promised land. And I think we're in a renaissance period now with endurance sports where people are realizing that it's not just who can press the gas pedal the hardest. It's those that have a more intelligent approach to training where there's a lot of restraint. There's some variation. You use that term polarity, which is becoming popular, where they're identifying that, most of the time spent should be at comfortable heart rates, and then a small fraction of the time can be spent at very high intensity explosive workouts and a very minimal amount of time in that in-between land where it's kind of like a race, right? I mean, the in-between zone that we disparage so commonly is kind of like your Ironman race pace on the bike, let's say. Huh. So, what I'm advocating is once in a while, you can go do a simulated race and experience great benefit, but perhaps the next four or five workouts on the heels of that are recovery pace, where you're just dawdling along and turning the pedals over and enjoying the sights and scenery in your neighborhood rather than trying to get an official quantifiable training session that you're going to upload onto Strava and track against your usual time. I mean, the athlete doesn't respect the need to do that specific race applicable workout enough. And there's also not enough respect for the value of recovery workouts, rest days, and trading in, let's say, a 6 mile tempo run for a 60-minute walk in the park with your child. I mean, the latter has a definite training benefit. Phil Maffetone talks about this in detail. Any aerobic activity delivers an aerobic training benefit. And so when you walk in the park and you lead an active lifestyle, but don't overstress your body with yet another medium to difficult workout, you are getting a training benefit that will actually directly improve your result when you're, competing on the highest stage with your goal race of a half Ironman or Ironman or whatever you're doing.
So that just before I've got something I'd like to interject there, which will lead in nicely from what you just said. Going back though to training volumes, I saw one of my friends was advising Lionel Sanders up to Kona, and I was listening to some of the stuff they were talking about. Lionel was talking about his average week was 16 hours from July to Kona. So he didn't start his build up until July. I guess that must have been after he'd won that champions race in Slovenia. So July, August, September. So 3 months plus the 2 weeks in October. Averaging 16 hours. Biggest training week, 25 hours. He said he very rarely went at race pace unless he was racing. He did some higher intensity intervals, but a lot of his workouts were lower intensity, although people might find that hard to believe given his sort of supposed functional threshold. But I think that was quite interesting. And then there are some fantastic examples in the Primal Endurance book of athletes that buck the trend and have much lower volumes. There's one that I'd read before. I saw it in here actually, which is Sami Inkinen, the Finnish guy who won his age group in Kona. And he doesn't look like a triathlete at all, does he? He looks like an American footballer. He's a big, muscular guy, but he's certainly got an endurance engine. But you mentioned that walking in the park, something that most triathletes would just swipe away as being meaningless, provides aerobic benefit. And you in the book, and I have adopted this, and I know a lot of other people have, from Phil Maffetone, this MAF, max aerobic frequency, which is 100, a heart rate of 180 minus your age. So perhaps you can explain, Brad, how that works and why it's different from the standard 220 minus your age.
It stands for maximum aerobic function. Okay. And so what we're trying to identify is the maximum aerobic heart rate, which is completely distinct from maximum heart rate.
Yeah.
And so the maximum aerobic heart rate is the point where your maximum aerobic stimulation occurs with a minimal amount of anaerobic stimulation. It's the point of maximum fat burning. So the maximum fat calories are being burned at this heart rate. And if you were to increase your speed, increase your effort, you would burn more glucose and less fat. You'd burn more total calories. If you're running 6 minute miles, you're burning 900 calories an hour. If you're running 8 minute miles, you're only burning 700 or whatever. I'm making those up. But when you're at that magic spot, that maximum aerobic spot, it's a very comfortable pace, but it's the point where you're putting the maximum fat through your system and a minimal amount of glucose. But if you were to continue going faster, you'd spike glucose and fat burning would subside. The important point there physiologically is that in endurance sports, we're trying to, it's basically a contest of who's the best at burning fat.
Yeah.
And that's where you can go to the finish line and, watch the guy who come first, watch the guy who come 12th, watch the guy who come 112th. And the guy is winning because he's better at burning fat and preserving glycogen, because we know that, a sugar burning athlete will poop out after, a couple minutes. If you have a person from the crowd that's asked to run at the Ironman race pace of Lionel Sanders or whoever, they're only going to last for a block or two, and then they're going to be completely anaerobic and they're going to collapse on the lawn. So it's all a question of how good are you at burning energy for a sustained period of time. We have tons of fat to burn, tens of thousands of calories. We have a very small amount of glucose to burn that we have to preserve over the course of, very long events. And so your listeners have probably heard of the ketogenic diet, where you train yourself to become less dependent and have less need for glucose, both for the brain and for the muscles, and the performance advantage that delivers. But the key point to talk about here is when you limit your heart rate to that 180 minus age number. So if I'm 50, 180 minus 50 equals 130. That's my maximum aerobic heart rate. And that's the point where I'm going to set the beeper on my watch and conduct my aerobic training sessions at that heart rate or anywhere below that heart rate. And so what I'm doing is I'm stimulating aerobic development. I'm teaching my body to become better at burning fat, and I'm staying away from those glucose burning heart rates, which I want to stimulate once in a while, but not too frequently, because it increases the stress impact of the workout. So it takes longer to recover. You're burning more sugar, you're craving sugar afterwards, so you're locking yourself back into this carbohydrate dependency pattern rather than progressing toward being fat adapted, being better at burning fat through dietary modification as well as comfortable training.
Can I ask you a question, Brad, because this does come up a lot with this formula. Is that formula 180 minus your age, although you can vary that, can't you, if you've had 2 years of continuous training without injury or illness, you can add 5 onto that, so it becomes 185 minus age. Is that right?
I feel like most people are, and we've done so many shows on this on the Primal Endurance podcast. So if you want to go over there and subscribe, there's all kinds of great content, and the titles and descriptions will lock you right into the topics of your most interest. But we have a prevailing mentality of people wanting to negotiate for more heartbeats and, and make a justification for, and people will come back and say, well, I got tested in the lab and guess what? My maximum aerobic heart rate is 145. And what we're doing is like, we're confusing laboratory terminology. We're making this thing way more complex than we should. And we're also failing to recognize that working at any pace below that maximum aerobic heart rate, even many, many beats below that 180 minus age number, still delivers an excellent aerobic training benefit. So when I refer back to my time competing as a professional and trying to go, you know, as fast as possible against the best competition, I did the vast majority of my workouts at 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 beats below my maximum aerobic heart rate. So I would commonly go out there and pedal my bike at a heart rate of 105, which is, you know, 15, 16, 17 miles an hour on the flat. And it would just be like a breeze in the park. But I was spinning the pedals. I was teaching my nervous system to fire those legs in a circular manner. I was working my heart rate above the resting rate significantly. And I was not putting any stress on my body. I was just enhancing my ability to bicycle and, you know, to time trial at maximum speed on those days when I did that. Those slow workouts contributed directly to more ability to perform at a higher level because I was getting out there and pedaling a lot. But it has to, you know, we have to get away from this desire to constantly, you know, push the highest level of speed on all our workouts.
So the questions that arise are, does that 180 minus age is across all the workouts? It doesn't, because we know that max heart rate on the bike is generally a bit lower than the run. So it doesn't change between biking and running?
No, it doesn't change. Good question. And that's because running is more stressful, right?
Yeah.
So if you're pedaling at, you know, if you're pedaling at a heart rate of 135 and you're running at a heart rate of 135, you know, you're going to be going pretty fast on the bike because it's not as stressful as running. If you're hitting 135 and you're jogging and walking on your run and you're super frustrated, well, guess what? You can go pedal on your bike and work harder. And especially in swimming is so, it's so much less stressful to the body than running, that you can go and swim intervals and you'll still be in the aerobic zone. So it's really respecting the extreme difficulty of running as a sport and noticing that even at a moderate pace, you start to work pretty hard really easily.
So
it might not be a big deal in your area, but when it's a hot summer day,
yeah,
the athlete heads out the door for a training session and it's already, you know, 88 with 88% humidity, that's going to entail a much slower paced run than normal, than your fall or winter speed, but you're still honoring the heart rate as the representation of what the difficulty and the metabolic effect of the workout is. So when we're at altitude or when we're in a cold, super cold or super hot, you know, we adjust our speed according to the impact on the heart. And that's, you know, that's starting to get intelligent about training rather than just indiscriminate and overly competitive.
That's not relevant at all in the UK, Brad, I'm afraid. I'm only kidding. We do get, and we do, when it's warm here in the summer, we do get reasonably high humidity, more so than sort of Southern Europe. But so, but that point
okay,
you bring
well,
up.
Here's a, let me throw another one in. If you go sit down and have a cup of coffee before your morning run, you're ingesting an artificial central nervous system stimulant, your heart rate's going to be elevated and you're going to set out the door. And because of the, you know, the stress of that ingested drug, you might find that your heart rate elevates higher than it would if you had not ingested that beverage because you're getting a central nervous system stimulant into your body. So that's one of my things, that anything that's going on, if you wake up and you're a little bit ill with compromised immune function, or you're still recovering from your previous hard effort or your previous race, it's going to be reflected in your crappy pace with your heart rate beeping. And you're like, wait a second, I don't have to walk up this hill. I usually jog up the hill, but not today. And that's when you start to, you know, honor taking what your body gives you each day and nothing more.
So, I mean, that's the one complaint that we get from people. You mentioned how much more stressful on the body running is than cycling because you're using so many more muscles are involved, is that people have to walk. But what we're saying is that the heart rate, the heart gets the workout whether you swim, bike or run. So if you want harder workouts, you can do those swimming and running and cycling workouts. Your heart doesn't know, does it? It's your brain that knows whether you're running. Your heart just beats in response to the demand from the muscles for oxygen. So that's right. The one thing. We talked about nose breathing. If you don't like to be governed by your heart rate, or even if we're trying to go by that intuitive training thing and learn to what our body's telling us, because we all know how gadgets malfunction at the wrong time in the middle of a race when you need them, the best athletes have always been able to do stuff by feel. So let's take a couple of minutes to talk about nose breathing, Brad, about not just a health benefit, but also a way of gauging athletic performance.
Yeah, fun stuff. This, you know, I was exposed to this way back in the late 90s with a great book called Body, Mind, and Sport by John Dooliard. And one of the things he talked about was nose breathing. And it's becoming popular now recently. One thing that it makes you do is it forces you to use the diaphragm in the proper manner to obtain a breath, because it's more difficult to draw air through your nose when your mouth is closed. And so you take these deep, efficient diaphragmatic breaths where you expand the diaphragm. You kind of, on the inhalation, your stomach expands. And then on the exhalation, your stomach contracts. And it's kind of the opposite of this shallow, panting, high-stress breath where people inhale by raising their chest up in the air and sucking their stomach in. That's the opposite of the proper breathing technique. To what you're trying to do is you're trying to obtain air from or exchange air from the oxygen-rich lower lobes of the lung rather than just using the upper part of the lung. So when you're running along and you're experimenting with this nose breathing during a comfortably paced run, first you're getting a really efficient air exchange and really deep, efficient breaths with each draw of the breath. And secondly, it's a kind of a layperson's guide to maintaining what is likely to be an aerobic pace rather than exceeding that magic number, that maximum aerobic heart rate of 180 minus H. Because when your mouth is closed and you start going too fast, you're going to have you're going to run out of air just getting it through your nose. I know people try to cheat this, and I've become really good at breathing so well through my nose that I can speed up past my aerobic heart rate. So I always advocate wearing that heart rate monitor anyway. Mm. But it's a great way to kind of just reduce the stress impact of the workout. Dooliard's book talks about that too, where your nose breathing is stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the often called the rest and digest or the relaxation elements of the autonomic nervous system, whereas the shallow panting breaths that we normally take even during our busy workday where we're rushing around the office or when we're going out and not paying attention to our breath when we're doing aerobic workout, we're activating the sympathetic or the fight or flight component of the autonomic nervous system, and that increases the stress impact of the workout because we're taking these inefficient breaths.
What we'll say there is that if you are going to try nose breathing, be prepared for the first couple of weeks to be a little bit snotty. It's going to generate a bit of mucus out of your nose. You're going to feel like you can breathe out, but your nose is running. When you breathe in, the nostrils stick together a bit because you've got some snot in there. You will get over that. It's something that I've experienced. Brad's probably experienced it too. And everybody that I've recommended it to said that the first couple of weeks got a bit messy. But afterwards, your nose and your nasal passages get used to it. If you want, try those Breathe Right nose strips that just pull the nostrils apart a little bit. Might help. There's another book that I've been reading, Brad, which you might be interested in, called The Oxygen Advantage, which is maybe a more updated version of the book you were mentioning by Patrick McCowan. And he talks about teaching yourself to breathe through your nose by using a little bit of that Scotch tape to tape up your mouth. A little extreme, but maybe that'll be what some people need to correct those bad habits. Okay, well, look,
yeah,
Brad.
I've heard other podcasters talk about mouth taping and all that. It's pretty funny, yeah. But... there's stuff to it, and there's research to it, and
yeah,
it's worth trying out, especially just giving it a shot for a few minutes of your next run, just pulling some deep breaths through your nose. It feels really great to activate that diaphragm.
Now, what I should say here is that we're not talking about this improving your, I mean, there may be some benefits here. We're not talking about this improving your lung size or your oxygen transport capacity. But what we are talking about is there are benefits from breathing through your nose, like the release of nitrous oxide into your system. You can read about that in the book, because I don't know enough about it to explain it fully here. But we're also talking about breathing properly, breathing using your diaphragm rather than the upper chest, and that is a bad habit to get into. And if you ask several of your friends at work to take a big deep breath in and just watch what happens, you will see that they lift their shoulders up and they expand the pectoral area of the chest. Not many people will show an expansion of the sort of area beneath the rib cage and the stomach, which is what Brad described. And try that yourself, see what happens. So, Brad, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Let's see if we can create a template based on this, because we're still in the selling process of convincing those naysayers that this is the right way to go. Let's see if we can create a template for healthy living and training following the Primal Endurance Way. And then, once we've done that, if people want more information, they can join your mastery course. How about that?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. It's great, especially, being far away. We're talking across the globe here, and we spend a lot of time creating this comprehensive online multimedia educational course based around the content of the book Primal Endurance. So if you enjoyed the book, this course brings the book to life with a series of instructional videos. And I traveled all over North America and interviewed the world's leading experts in endurance training and physiology and diet and science, and put together some amazing content that'll give you basically everything you need to succeed with your endurance efforts. It's all over at primalendurance.fit. We have a great Facebook group that's really lively and engaging, the Primal Endurance Facebook group, and you can go on there and post questions. And our resident expert, Dr. Lindsay Taylor, who's an Ironman triathlete and also a behavioral psychologist, shares a lot of the psychological aspects of, let's say, adhering to a training schedule or a training philosophy, because we were talking about convincing people and some of the things that get in the way. So it's a comprehensive effort to help people do this stuff right, because it's very, very daunting and difficult, these goals and these race distances that they put up arbitrarily, like the Ironman or the marathon. Huh. And it's a big ask for the busy person with a family, a job, and things to do all day to try to get competent at these big events without breaking down and falling apart. So.
Well, that's one of the things that gets me, Brad, as well, is that, you know, challenging yourself to just finish an event like that is good enough to consider yourself a superhuman, really, in the context of most of society. But then people say, yeah, but I need to do it in a respectable time. I still haven't quite worked out how one determines what is a respectable time and therefore what's disrespectable or non-respectable. You know, if you see people, I mean, I've been on the finish line catching people in Kona. I commentate at races in the UK. I've watched people probably that you coach come across the line in 10 hours and win their age group. I've also watched people come across the line with a few minutes to spare before before the clock stops at 17 hours. And I when I see those people coming in at 17 hours, I think, man, you've been out there a long time. That's an awful lot of determination and guts and stamina. That is respect. But putting that to one side, we've got this Primal Endurance lifestyle. There's some differences to training. So I'd like to finish off by maybe outlining three or four key principles that people can start to put into practice tomorrow, and three or four key principles they can put into practice with their nutrition and lifestyle. So can you sort of bullet point those for me and just give a sentence to clarify? Let's start with training.
Well, training, you got to slow down.
Slow down. Yep. That's a big ask for most triathletes.
yeah. And, you know, just kind of de-emphasize the anxiety and the importance of every single workout and just go with the flow. And I like to say, take what your body gives you each day and nothing more as your primary training philosophy, rather than trying to force things to happen that aren't naturally meant to be.
And I would say there that we could do that in reverse. So if you do have a program and the program says today is an easy day and you get up and feel absolutely fantastic, you can feel in your warm up that you're flying, then make the most of that while you feel it, because tomorrow or the day after you may be feeling a bit shitty and you'll have to go easy. So it can happen in reverse, can't it?
Oh, for sure. What happens is you free yourself from these constraints of the obsessive compulsive approach and the obsessive compulsive type A mindset. And that allows you to, pursue higher highs and then also absorb and respect some lower lows than, the prevailing approach, which is to just keep grinding every day and thinking that if you take a day off, you're going to get out of shape. It's just not true. And it's been proven over and over with good science and the performances of elite athletes. And also everyone out there who has reference points, like my favorite one is, when I'd get sick and I'd catch a cold for 2 weeks and I'd miss my training and I'd be out of the pool for a while. And then I'd go back to the pool the first time, having greatly reduced training volume for the previous 2 or 3 weeks. And I'd go in there and I'd be hitting PRs and I'd be like, wow, that's funny. I haven't swum that much in the previous 3 weeks. And here I am better than I've been the whole year. And you just shake your head and go, wow, that's cool. But, you got to think deeper and say, gee, maybe the rest did me well and allowed all those months of hard training and banging my shoulders and straining my deltoids and getting those aching muscles the day after those hard swim workouts. Maybe you allow those things to sink in and balance in a little more recovery and then experience performance breakthroughs accordingly.
Good. So we've got slow down. Would pay more respect to rest be part of your training tips as well then?
Yeah, we could say for a quip, it's like rest like a champion and, tone down that that competitive intensity is great on the starting line on race day, but we have to tone that down. We have to pay more respect to, the ebbs and flows of our energy, our moods, and our motivation levels and take those very, very seriously. So when you don't feel like doing something and you're, identified as a highly motivated, driven, highly accomplished triathlete and human in the world, if you don't feel like going to the workout, that's a strong sign that, we need to make some changes here because we want to have that high motivation and high enthusiasm at all times, especially if you're doing it recreationally. But people, will make the mistake that, they think the elite is the most serious and driven and focused one and everyone else is doing it for fun. But an elite with a bad attitude who forces their body to do things that they shouldn't will also suffer just like anyone who's, doing it recreationally. So the rules apply to everyone, no matter what level you're at.
Okay, slow down, rest like a champion. Let's give them something to do with training. You talked about lifting heavy weights before. That's strength and conditioning is also something that we need to convince endurance athletes to do more of. Not even... Because I come from a strength and conditioning background. For me, it's not about performance improvements from being more powerful. It's about making your body more robust to withstand injury. And again, if we stand on the side of the road watching an endurance race, most people are not slowing down because they're out of breath, are they? They're slowing down because their body's failing them. So they've got a good engine and a poor chassis.
That's funny. Yeah, and I think... there might be some, difference of opinion on this topic because there's so much nuance to it. But when I think about strength training, I think that I want to complement all the endurance work that I'm already very, very good at and put so much time into it. Yep. So I'm strongly against those blended workouts where you go into the gym and you lift light weights and you do a ton of reps and a ton of sets because all that is another endurance workout.
Yeah.
I'll give you a high rep strength training session. It's called running 6 miles and having your feet turn over at 60 times a minute for an hour. That's a high rep strength training session. So what we want to do is focus on kind of your weaknesses and the complementary things. And guys are doing a good job with this, with these like CrossFit endurance platforms where, you're doing things like jumping up and down off a box 10 times. Or loading up a bar and doing some deep squats, because this is kind of approximating what's happening to your body when you hit mile 20 of the marathon and your hip flexors are blown out. So when it's time to go hard, do explosive and short duration workouts rather than long duration workouts that aren't very explosive.
And would we, that explosive short duration as well as in the weight room, would you bring that into swim, bike and run stuff as well? So you have maybe... you familiar with Tabata workouts?
Yeah, all those things where you can, rev the engine up to maximum intensity. I just did a podcast with Dave Scott about this on the Primal Endurance podcast. So you can go over there and search for that show. But he's a big fan of like blasting blasting that cardiovascular system out with super high intensity, short duration intervals. And he likes to do those frequently and believes that that can give you, you know, kind of a faster progression with your aerobic fitness when you're working that high end once in a while. Of course, these are more stressful than just jogging, but definitely you should become competent even at a sprint as short a duration as 100 meters. Because if you can get good at running, you know, 6 times 100 meters across the soccer field, this is going to directly translate into a better performance at 10K, at half marathon, and at marathon, because you're becoming more explosive, your stride becomes more efficient, your oxygen exchange, your fat metabolism, all these things are turbocharged when you work at the high intensity and do the explosive stuff. And a little goes for such a long way that, you know, we're talking about throwing in a couple sprint workouts a month can make a huge difference for even an iron level, iron distance triathlete trying to improve.
Well, we had some triathletes try swimming with the sprint group. So these are guys, they're guys in their 40s. They swim in masters events. That's all they do. And several of them are British and European 50 meter record holders. So the triathletes are swimming there. All they had to do in the session was they did a 1,000 meter warm up, and then they did 6 25 meter sprints off the blocks. Right, followed by they went one at a time. And there were six of them, so you got about 6 or 7 minutes rest, which for triathlete, 6 or 7 minutes between a 20-second effort was completely the opposite way of training.
That's crazy. I'd be shivering, man. That's I need to go sit in a jacuzzi.
Well, we let them swim up and down the pool really easy, but you know.
Good.
But so they weren't just sitting at the pool on the poolside. But what there were several things that we found. One, whilst their heart rates came down very quickly and aerobically they recovered, the central nervous system and the muscular system didn't recover as quickly. So even though they'd had long rest, their times tailed off towards the sort of fifth and sixth rep. The next thing was that the sprint coaches were asking them to turn their arms over quicker because the cadence was too slow. But they said they felt like a drowning man trying to get out of a pool full of piranhas. You know, they couldn't turn their arms over any quicker. So they just hadn't learned to twitch the muscle fibers that quickly. And it just felt so untidy. But after several weeks of this training, what we got back from the triathletes was exactly what you just mentioned a minute ago, Brad, that intensities at slightly lower levels, 80 to 90% threshold racing levels, suddenly felt so comfortable. They felt so in control of the performance when they were swimming at that sort of threshold pace. They suddenly realized the benefits of going really high intensity. And also, I think we were exposing them to a training intensity that most of them never really get to. They don't ever train that hard. So that was them converted onto super high intensity training.
It sounds like so much fun too, to go and actually, you know, explore high speed swimming rather than just suffering through another aerobic workout. You know, we all get, you know, we in the endurance community, we all get an A+ score for our endurance. Mm-hmm. And then for our muscular strength and our muscular endurance, you know, we're somewhere between B+ and C-. And then, you know, with the explosiveness and the ability to perform under, you know, under heavy load, you know, that's, we're getting D's and F grades. So, you know, getting weight on that bar and doing some squats is, again, it's like short circuiting what's happening to the training effect of starting at mile 20 and running the last 6 miles, which of course you can't do more than a couple times a year, but you can do box jumps and do heavy squats, you know, as part of your training routine at certain times of the year. And in primal endurance, we spend a lot of time covering the concept of periodization so that you have focused periods of the year where you emphasize this type of explosive training. And as a consequence, you de-emphasize the accumulation of high volume, which is best placed to another distinct period of the year where you're more focused on volume. You're not really worrying about, you know, doing explosive workouts or adhering to some schedule where you're trying to do it all each week, but you're taking more of a focused approach. So, you know, the student can learn these principles that apply in general philosophical terms, and then plug in, you know, the particulars of what works best for you instead of, you know, what we're not offering with the video course and in the book is like cookie cutter template where, you know, we're telling you what workouts to do, because there's, you know, those variables are best determined by the individual and all the other circumstances that are important to consider.
Okay, let's just move on then. So, you know, these are very loose principles, and a lot of people will, we've just been teaching a course to triathlon coaches in the UK, and one of the things that they got really confused and quite steamed up about was the fact that we didn't give them this specific structure, that we said it was like free-form learning. You have to decide which path you're taking and work out what's best for you, and then choose which things you want to gain learning and experience in. They wanted structure. They wanted to be told what they had to learn, because that's how education's always been done. And triathletes are like that with this training. So with the training, we haven't given them any specifics, but we said you need to slow down a bit and go towards the bottom end of the spectrum. You need to embrace resting like a champion and listen to your body. We need to add some explosive activity, so the strength and conditioning components to complement all of the other aerobic fitness are doing, some really super high intensity training either in the weight room or with some sprinting stuff like we just discussed, and they need to think about periodizing, going into some high intensity work and then back to some endurance work to support that, back to more high intensity work. Have I got that right there, Brad?
Very well done. Lovely summary.
Okay. Let's see if we can summarize quickly then on some more lifestyle things, because training, none of this training is going to have the benefit it deserves unless we support it with an exemplary lifestyle, which allows us to create an environment for the body to flourish and for the training to flourish. So what sort of things could they be doing there which will help?
Oh my gosh, you know what? Rather than load you up with all this stuff, I'm just going to say sleep more. And if you can focus on that and leave this show with that lasting memory that, you know, the sleep is the gateway to improve performance, all other things being equal, you can probably afford to sleep more, and it'll serve you wonderfully.
Do you know what, Brad? I'm so glad you've said that. I had a guy, there's an English sleep coach expert called Nick Littlehales. He wrote a book called Sleep. If you've not read that, I thoroughly recommend it. I had Nick on my podcast, and if you want, I could probably introduce him to you as well for yours. And also, there's a book that you may have come across by a guy called Sean Stevenson. He's from your side of the pond, called Sleep Smarter. So two really good books there. And again, you know, if we were inventing sleep today, Brad, and we put it on the market tomorrow and told everybody of the benefits, I think we'd be billionaires overnight. And it's free, though, isn't it? And it's underutilized.
Yeah. And so rather than just, you know, once again, paying lip service to it, this is not a new concept. I'm going to send you home with some marching orders, which is, after it gets dark in your environment, try to minimize your exposure to artificial light and digital stimulation of all forms. So I know this is tough in the winter, because in the UK, it's getting dark at 4:30, yep, and you're usually not going to sleep until 10 or 11, but your behavior in the winter needs to be modified to entail more sleep, because that's what our genetic expectation for health is. And in the summer, you can get away with less sleep because it's lighter in your environment. But when you minimize your exposure to artificial light and digital stimulation after dark, you will align your hormones with your optimal genetic expectation to sleep more in the winter, sleep less in the summer, and have evenings that are mellow and quiet and dark, and doing things like strolling with the dog around the neighborhood, quiet socializing, reading, and staying away from those Netflix marathons where you're just getting blasted with, you know, light and stimulation into your brain and suppressing the release of the prominent sleep hormone melatonin in favor of stress hormones that keep you awake while you're finishing your emails at 10:45 at night.
Well, you've probably just reminded me there, Brad, that I need to get out of this office, turn off 3 computers and my phone, and go and have something to eat and read my book. So might be a good point to end there. I really thank you, Brad. I'm going to summarize in a minute, and I'll give people your details where they can contact you. And then you mentioned some of the stuff by James O'Keefe, the Body, Mind and Sport, a couple of the websites, your Primal Endurance podcast, and some of the guests you've had on. We'll put those in the show notes. So Once again, Brad Cairns, thank you very much. You've been really insightful. We probably could have, we've broken a record here today and a rule because we've gone on for 45 minutes. So you are now top of the leaderboard for the longest podcast. So being still a competitive athlete, I know you'll be happy about that. So yeah, thanks, Brad. Any final departing words from you?
Oh, thank you so much, Simon. I love people to come visit us at primalendurance.fit and sign up for the podcast, subscribe to the podcast. Have a great day and enjoy your training.
Okay, so Brad, thank you very much. I'm Simon Ward signing out, but not before I've told you about my special gift. If you would like to email triathlon success to beth@thetriathloncoach.com, you can get 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies from 20 years of coaching and competing in triathlon. I've squeezed it down into just 3 pages of content and it's free for you. And don't forget to join our free Facebook community, the Triathlon Coach Cafe, which Brad says he's going to be a part of, so you can ask him all of your questions about MAF minus 180 training and everything else. So, yep, from me, Simon Ward, from Brad Cairns, it's over and out. Bye-bye for now.